Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome back to another spine-tingling edition of Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I've got to tell you, we've got some incredible guests today, as always. One person linked up with a distant cousin to find a quilt, a Civil War-era quilt put together by an ancestor. 320 names on this thing. And they're doing research into each of those people and what their involvement was with the Civil War. It's great stuff, coming up with Richard Boston out of the Loveland, Colorado area in just a little bit. And then later in the show, Hank Jones is back. He is the author of a series of books about the strange, serendipitous things that happen to people who do family history research. And he's got three stories that just might make your skin crawl. I mean, just strange stuff coming up later on in the show. But right now, let's check in with Boston and our good friend David Allen Lambert. Hello, David.
Greetings from Beantown, Fish. How you doing?
Yeah, I am doing so well. And we got a couple of emails this week before we even get started with you. I got this one from Maxine Yarborough. Maxine is an antiques dealer, and she said, I recently heard on the program that someone's ancestor was executed by hanging. And she said, I would like to politely correct the past tense of the word hang/hung. The correct verb when referring to a person is hanged. Pictures are hung. People are hanged. Thank you for
that
all the good
true.
Work.
That is true.
All right, David. So what do you have for us today in your family histoire news?
Well, you know, the first thing I just want to toss out there, we always talk about what we should not do in public. One of them is not talk about religion and politics. But have you ever wondered who your ancestors voted for?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I was able to determine one of them by the names that my other ancestors were given. For instance, my grandfather was named Winfield Scott Hancock Fisher. Well, Winfield Scott Hancock was running for president the year that my grandfather was born. So I figured that kind of made it very obvious that my great-grandfather was a Democrat.
And the oral tradition, my grandmother told me that they had been Republicans since the time of Lincoln. So I don't know if that meant every election, but it does give us a clue. That's why it's so important to keep a journal and write things down.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, getting to news, the first thing I want to say is congratulations to James Mather, who found this amazing Viking hoard in Watlington, England. Jewelry, coins, silver ingots. We talked about this before, but better yet for James, it is now considered a British treasure.
Oh, that's awesome.
You never know what you can find when you're looking for other man's junk from a long ago.
That's true.
So, you know, bury a bag of coins and some bottle caps in your backyard, Fish. You never know, someone might dig them up and find them as treasure someday.
Yep.
Okay, back in 2012, a large 55-ton ship called a Medieval Cog was found in a river in Holland. This vessel dates back to the medieval era, and most of it was stripped, and it looks strongly that the ship was put into the harbor to deter traffic, but it laid in the silt, and most of it is still preserved. A lot of the fittings were taken off, but they found a brick kiln oven
wow.
in the hulk of the ship in the galley. So they're trying to dry it out. The process could take up to 3 years, but they're hoping to preserve this ancient wreck from long ago.
That's incredible.
I'd like to give my sympathies to the family of Tommy L. Gaines, 93, who passed away recently. He was a Buffalo soldier and reported to be the last from South Carolina.
Wow.
He served in World War II in the all-black unit, the 27th Cavalry. And you look at a lot of the different units that had served since the time of the Civil War, and it's sad to think that the twilight on these brave African Americans is coming forward. But again, on the positive side, the units were then integrated. So the segregation of the Buffalo soldier became a thing of the past after World War II.
That's right.
Now I want to just jump into my tech tip. The old handwriting that we look at week to week as genealogists and as historians sometimes can be puzzling. When you study a handwriting example from one person, after a while, the letters that will come out on recognizable words can be applied to the curvature of letters in the words you're having trouble with, and often that will solve the problem. But the National Archives in England offers a free paleography course, which is a study of handwriting. And I've put the tip right up there under Gen Tips. It's the nationalarchives.gov www.ucdev.uk, and it's a great course. I have the 1850 United States slave schedules available. So this is a great free database.
Oh, that's great.
That's all I have from Beantown this week, and we'll catch you next time around.
Thank you, David.
Take care.
And coming up next, we're going to be talking with a man whose ancestor created a quilt from the Civil War era with 320 names on it. Who were they? What was their relationship to the family? What's he finding out about it? We'll talk to Richard Boston in Colorado. Coming up next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. On ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And as you know, we go looking in places like the London Times or the New York Times, and often some little Gazette in Kentucky. But I found one recently from the Reporter Herald in the Loveland, Colorado area, written by Pamela Johnson, about a man who made a connection with a relative, and they have this quilt made by this common ancestor. And I have him on the phone with us right now, Richard Boston. Richard, welcome to the show. Nice to have you.
Well, thank you, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I don't want to spoil anything about what you've done. Tell us a little background about how you connected with this cousin and this project that you've developed around this quilt.
Okay. I was recently retired or semi-retired, was trying to update our family tree, and found our great-great-grandfather, James, and his wife, Carolyn Boston, on a family tree that was actually on the kite family tree.
Okay.
And showed it as a great-great-grandmother to this person as well. So I got interested, but there was a note that the person had a family Civil War quilt, had been tucked away for about 40 years. And so I got really excited, made an email contact or tried to, and thought nobody'd answer. And lo and behold, within about a day, it turns out a third cousin, Gladys Irene Kite from Stockton, California, answered and started to explain about this Civil War quilt that she had inherited. That explanation, as it evolved, was a quilt that had 320 names hand-embroidered into patches on the quilt.
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the common ancestor for you, it was a second great-grandmother to each of you, right?
That is correct.
So a third cousin.
Exactly.
The interesting thing about this to me is all these names on there, they couldn't all be related to your ancestor as family.
Yeah, it turns out the only two names that are related are James and Caroline, both have their names embroidered in, but the other 318 are Civil War soldiers, their names, and the units in which they served.
And so what have you been able to determine about these other 318? Why are they on this quilt? What was your great-great-grandmother's connection?
We don't exactly know yet. We're still trying to figure that out, and some other questions. Gladys had the story from her grandmother that the quilt had been made by Caroline, who actually had become a Civil War nurse at Benton Barracks during the Civil War, and that the names were all patients of hers. Her husband, James, our great-great-grandfather, was wounded and sent to Benton Barracks and spent time there. So that's where we started.
Now, that's the St. Louis area, right?
Exactly. St. Louis, Missouri, Benton Barracks General Hospital. So that's where we started. And as we started to do research, currently medical records are very difficult to find, but undaunted, we started to look at all these. And it doesn't appear that most of the soldiers were in Benton Barracks or cared for there by Caroline. But we say that because of 100, and I think as of this morning, 191 individuals we've done a good amount of research on, 125 of them actually wound up living in Kansas, at least for a time after the Civil War.
So there might be a connection there as well.
Exactly, because the great-great-grandparents originally homesteaded in Nebraska, but by 1894, they'd relocated to Smith Center, Kansas. And so we think there's some connection there.
So you have basically done this research in nearing 200 of the 318 other people in here to find out who they were. And I remember seeing in Pamela's article something about somebody tied to Lincoln was on there. What was the story behind that?
Yes, John Holmes, the Union Light Guard Ohio Cavalry. In 1863, that unit was selected to be bodyguard to President Lincoln. He was a private in the cavalry, and he not only was a bodyguard to Lincoln, but the night of the assassination, John Holmes was on guard outside of Ford's Theater and was unable to change the course of history, basically. But he also, later that night, after Lincoln was shot, stood guard over Lincoln's body until Lincoln passed away.
So he was in his presence at that time. Unbelievable.
That's correct. Exactly.
Now, have you been in touch with the families of any of these individuals?
We have, and that's part of our intention, is connect with at least a few living descendants of soldiers. And fortunately, we were able to locate descendants of John Earl Holmes. After the war, Mr. Holmes and his wife settled in north central Kansas, near where the great-great-grandparents lived, and subsequently then moved to Topeka. Well, we located living descendants of John Holmes, one who actually started a shoe store in a town about 7 miles from where I currently live. But we also found that the original John Earl Holmes was buried in Topeka without a headstone. And so we actually had a headstone made for he and his wife, and then ordered one from the Veterans Administration, a Civil War headstone, and had those put in place in Topeka. And so the living descendants have been invited to attend a dedication of those two headstones in Topeka.
Oh, how fun. Are you going to go?
Yes, I definitely am going to be there.
So this is kind of a project that could go on for years and years and years.
Well, it could, yes. It's going a little faster now than when we first started, after you start to see some patterns. But we intend to publish a book kind of to teach history in a little more detailed way than the ordinary high school, remember the dates of certain battles and so forth. We want to use our family, the quilt, and the connection of these soldiers to teach what was going on before the war, during the war, and after the war. A lot of huge events that were happening that I think the quilt allows us to do that with. So the research for that could take several years.
So, obviously, you've spoken to your cousin on the phone many times, and you collaborate with her. Have you actually seen her, met her, and actually handled the quilt?
Well, the answer to the first couple of questions is not seen her, just photographs, telephone, and emailed. Last August, I was headed for a research trip back to Kansas and Nebraska to do some research on the family and hopefully find out the origin of the quilt, but for that trip, Gladys was kind enough to send the quilt back to us. And so, yes, I have held it with cotton gloves and actually had it appraised at the International Quilt Study Center and Museum in Lincoln, Nebraska at that time, and had it professionally photographed as well. The photography is just great. And some of the challenge of doing any genealogy, as you know, is, especially when things are in the cursive, is trying to determine exactly the spelling or what
right.
written. And it's kind of exacerbated because people were not just writing, but the names were embroidered by someone who was probably working from a list of names. So it really helps to look at the quilt. And it also has told us a couple of things. There's three distinct kind of stitching styles, so that leads us to believe there are at least three people helping to make this quilt, based on the cursive style of writing or embroidery.
Any idea who they were? And why would they do this? What's with the collaborative effort? Can you figure anything about that?
Well, we know that in Nebraska, Caroline was having quilting parties. There's no mention of this quilt. And so it was kind of a popular thing to do, is to get together with friends or family or neighbors to do quilting. This particular quilt, we don't know exactly why, or we don't know exactly know who. We believe it was Caroline and one of her daughters, and possibly a granddaughter. Got some reason for that, but we need to find some proof of it, I guess.
Right, and maybe the way to do it is to kind of match up some of the handwriting styles of the people you suspect might be involved in it.
Yeah, that might work. I don't know for sure if that's going to work. We're hoping still is local newspapers from Nebraska. I was able to get 30 years worth and found lots of tidbits about, like they said, quilting and other activities. And I need to go back to Smith Center to look at the microfilm of the local newspaper to see if they have columns there that might have some reference to this quilt being made.
Yeah, have you gone through newspapers.com or the National Archives Chronicling America?
Yes, both of those. And unfortunately, the two small newspapers, one in Nebraska and one in Smith Center, are not on either of those sites.
Okay. Have you checked genealogybank.com?
Have not checked that yet, no.
Yeah, they have different ones. That's the thing. There's an overlap on a lot of these services, but most of them have some that are unique to each site. So you might want to check that out. I hope that works out for you, because these small towns, there was an awful lot of minutia that was published in these papers back in those times.
Absolutely.
Well, this has obviously changed your life, Richard. What was it like when you held that quilt for the first time?
Well, I really had literally butterflies thinking about the connection way more than 100 years ago with all of those soldiers and the grandparents that are on there. And yeah, it was just unbelievable, because I grew up thinking our family had never done anything great. And what I realized in the last couple of years that all families have done something great, even if it's doing what you're supposed to do, paying taxes and going to work and raising a family. That's something in itself that's great.
Boy, you're absolutely right. All right, before we go, one or two little stories about people you found out of those 190 some odd that you've researched so far that stick in your brain.
Oh, boy. There are a couple of scoundrels on here. There's one that was married and forgot to get divorced and got married again and had 9 children and found out his former wife was already collecting his pension when he went to file for it.
Great stuff. Well, and I hope you're able to find some photographs of some of these people for your publication down the line. And let us know when you write your book.
All right. I definitely will.
All right. Great stuff. Richard Boston from the Loveland, Colorado area, working on a Civil War quilt made by his ancestor when he connected with a cousin. And Richard, you got to listen to the next segment coming up here with my friend Hank Jones, the writer. He's got an incredible story relating to that very hospital in St. Louis. It's coming up next.
Uh-oh.
It is Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with my good friend Henry Z. Hank Jones. He's one of those guys with all the letters after his name, which means he's really, really smart. Hank, how are you? Great to have
you
back.
Scott, good to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you. And hello to all your listeners.
And Hank is the author of just a ton of books relating not only to family history, but his showbiz life as well. He was in Disney movies and TV shows back in the day. And so it's kind of like you're two people, Hank.
Tell me. It's very, very spooky, very spooky.
And
it's nice. Actually, what was fun is show business, you know, you work in spurts, and I would do a movie or a TV show, and then sometimes you'd have a couple weeks off, sometimes you'd have a month off. And so what did I do? I went to the library and did research and climbed the family tree, and it actually was very therapeutic to have two loves of my life in the sense of careers, and I could go back and forth, and it got me through some slow times. It was great.
Well, and think about it, too. I mean, one involves being out there in front of everybody, and the other is just you by yourself and a machine.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, don't talk anymore about that. I think I'll hang up and go back to my machine.
Yeah, right, right. Well, Hank is the author of a series of books on serendipity and intuition and genealogy. And last spring, we did a segment with you, Hank, and talked about some of the crazy things you've run across and thought we'd go back to the well and see what else you've got for us, because you've got a long list of stuff here.
Well, what I did back about 1994 or so, weird stuff was happening to me as I was doing my research. I just couldn't explain it. And I wanted to know if I was the only one getting a little too close to the butterfly net. So what I did is I wrote to 200 of my colleagues around the world, that, you know, the really sharp people in genealogy, that has any of this stuff ever happened to you that you couldn't explain? And the responses are still coming in. I'm up to about 1,300, Scott,
wow,
around the world that are telling me their stories that, you know, they usually start with, well, I've never told this to anybody before, but here goes. And they lay one on me. And, you know, they're just amazing, some of these things. Now, this was written to me by Betty Williamson Chan in Linwood, Washington. About 20 years ago, she says she was in St. Louis with her family, and they had some time to kill before a baseball game, so they went to the top of the Gateway Arch. And they were looking around from that beautiful arch down below, and what did they see but a big building down below that had turned out to be the St. Louis County Courthouse. And to any genealogist worth his salt, it's almost, well, mm-hmm, goodbye ball game. I'm going to see what's in this courthouse. So Betty said she led her kids all the way down there, and they had this wonderful exhibit of the westward movement, dioramas and exhibits all through the courthouse. Well, about 20 years later, she says, she was doing research on her great-great-grandfather, Williamson. That was his last name. And she finally had his pension application. And it turned out that he was wounded in battle in the Civil War and was taken for hospitalization to the Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, Missouri.
Oh, my gosh.
And it turns out that the Jefferson Barracks today is the St. Louis County Courthouse. And in the pension papers, it said, the applicant complained so much that we not cut off his leg that we decided not to do it, and he will have to walk with a limp for the rest of his life.
Oh, my hair just stood up.
Yeah.
What was her reaction when she found that?
Totally stunned, she said. And she didn't know what to do with it. And she said, it was one of these, you won't believe this, but honest, this is what happened. So that was one
of them. Wow. You can't make that up.
No, you can't make that up. David Rencher, many of you know, David is an officer in the family history libraries all around the world. And Dave told me a story. It was told to him by a man named Lee Davidson, who works at the Family History Library in suburban Maryland, one of them. And Mr. Davidson was sitting at his computer in the library. All of a sudden, a lovely black woman walked in and sat at the computer right next to him. And she was wearing clothes, he said, of a very colorful African tribal design that suggested that, well, she might have been a Muslim. And so they worked side by side for a whole hour until Mr. Davidson just happened to look over at her computer screen right next to his. And Mr. Davidson said it took his breath away because on his own screen was the exact same information that was on her screen.
Oh, wow.
It was about a Maria Beeks, born almost 400 years ago in Holland. Maria Beeks was his 10th great-grandmother. So Mr. Davidson leaned over to the lady and asked her kind of an obvious but maybe kind of a strange question. He said, are you looking for Beeks in Holland? And she looked up startled and said, well, yes, I have Beeks ancestors. Well, he turned his computer monitor to the left. She turned her computer monitor to the right. And there indeed on the both screens was the same information. Yes, the black Muslim woman and the white Mormon men were both 10th great-grandchildren of Maria Beeks, born 399 years ago in Holland. Some of Maria's offspring immigrated to the Netherlands, and it reinforced in me two license plates, personalized, that I saw in California one time. One said, we are one, and the other said, I am you. And genealogy gives us a chance to do this every so often.
Yes.
We realize we are part of the human family.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah. But what really happens, I think, Scott, is that the little gentle ones, the little prods, the little nudges, I think the most common response that have come in from people around the world that are sort of interested in this in genealogy is that they say, once in a while, I feel kind of led. I feel like something is pushing or prodding or nudging me along to look in a place where information has no reason to be. And I follow it up, and many times, that's what the information is that I've been looking for all my life. So it does happen. It does happen, and it sure is fun.
It really is.
I think our ancestors want to be remembered. I don't know how it works. I think one of the successes with this book, why they're in our ninth printing now, is that I have no agenda. I'm not trying to push anything, because this happens to young, old, every ethnic group, very religious people, atheists. Nobody's got a hold on it. It happens to the humans. We're human. It happens to us.
It's happened to me. Good stuff. Hank, as always, just a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for sharing some of your very strange but fascinating stories.
Okay.
And coming up next, it's Tom Perry, our preservation authority on how you can fix the unfixable. On Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, it is Fisher here, your Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry. He is our preservation authority, and every week we talk about what's going on in that world. And Tom, in the world of roots tech, you're getting a lot of visits at the conference in Salt Lake City. Utah, with people bringing you all kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. We had people bring us boxes and tubs of things that, hey, you know, I didn't want to ship this. I feel a little bit uncomfortable, so I brought on the plane with me. What can we do with this? Which is awesome. It's an awesome idea if you can't find somebody local that you can trust that can do these for you. We had a lady that was doing some genealogy research on eBay and found somebody that had some old photographs that had glass on them, glass type positives. By dumb luck, she found out these are family people. So she bought the whole box.
Wow.
And so she brings it home. She's looking at it and thinking, oh, I need to get these scanned. She took it to a place which will remain nameless. However, what happened is she took them all in and they looked fine. When she went back to pick them up, some of them had turned yellow.
Oh, dear.
And she asked us what could have happened to these.
Right.
And the only thing that I could think of that could turn these bad in such a quick time would be some kind of heat. So since she had them all in a stack, it was just the ends. I could see somebody set them on a heater or something.
Oh.
But since they, you know, they weren't in order or whatever, the only thing we can figure out is they must have spread them out on a table. There must have been a heat duct right above the table they were working on. And maybe this individual got called up front to help somebody or got started on another job and left them there. And there was enough cycling of the heat coming on and off that yellowed some of these.
Oh, my goodness. Now, were they permanently destroyed, or is this something you can fix?
Well, of course, the original is permanently destroyed. Nothing you can do about it. However, the good news is that's not that hard of a fix. We can rescan it, take that scan, clean it up, get rid of the yellowing. And as kind of a note on this, a sidebar, which we've talked about in the past, whenever you scan black and white, still make sure you scan them in color. Don't think, oh, this is black and white, I'm going to scan it in grayscale. No, big mistake. Always scan everything in color. And then the first people ask me, well, I don't want it in color, I want it in grayscale. Okay, back up. Scan in color so you have more information. Now, once you have that more information, make a duplicate of that and turn it into grayscale. Then it'll look like you originally scanned it. So now, maybe 10 years from now or even a year from now, you might want to go back and say, you know what? There's some cracks and some spots in here I want to clean up. You go back to your original color, which has more information, and do your editing then, and then do it. Same thing like if you have a jar of sand or a jar of pebbles. You have a lot more stuff in the sand, so you want to always do it in color. So that's important. So we can take these, we can rescan them, and we can take the yellow out. So your prints are going to look great, but you'll always have in the back of your head these glass positives. Some of them are yellow. And if you're like me and you're OCD, it'll drive you nuts.
Oh, yeah. Just the idea of it, though. I mean, they were antiques. What era do you think we're talking about?
These were from, I believe she said, they started in the early 1900s. So, I mean, they were old stuff. They were like her great-grandparents.
Wow.
And, you know, some of them, she still doesn't even know who the people are. As you know, there's websites out there where you can upload things and they will go and search and sometimes they'll find face recognitions and find out who these people are. I also told her once we scan all of them, put them on your Facebook page, put them in any public places you can think of and put a little note that says, hey, we're trying to find out who these people are. And maybe somebody else will have the same luck you had that you're looking at this one and going, hey, that's my great grandfather. That's incredible. And somebody else will find out. You'll be able to help somebody else fill in some holes in their genealogy as well. It will make it really nice.
Yeah, post to a local area that you know that they're from.
Exactly. Because you never know who's going to happen to stumble across those. I mean, you hear all kinds of miracle stories. Another photograph we had come in was really, really sad. Somebody put their thumbprint right on a family photo. And as the years went over, it kind of destroyed that picture. And you never know what's on somebody's finger or thumb. But over the years, this was compounded. Plus, it was put in a frame that was facing a window, an open window. And so it had faded. It had the UV problem. So basically, this girl's face didn't exist anymore.
Oh, boy.
And unfortunately,
Was it a group thing?
Yeah, it was a group photo, like a family photo. And she happened to be in the photo. She was one of the people in the photo when she was young. So that helps us a little bit because we know who the person is. However, she has searched and searched and can't find any other photos of this person even close to this age. So we can't just go and say, oh, this is what she looked like, and have our artist go and redraw her. So we're going to have to kind of make it up as we go, kind of look at the face structure. It may not look like her, but we're going to make something that looks good.
Well, because you can't trash the entire picture. There are lots of other people in it. It's an era photograph.
Oh, exactly. We're going to do the best we can. This picture has been so faded, we can't even tell what color the people's clothes were originally. But she can remember enough to say, oh, I remember Sally, who's bottom left, used to have this yellow dress. So that way we can go back and try and make it as pure as possible. However, if this picture would have been older and she didn't know any of the people, we'd have to go and say, well, let's make her dress yellow. Let's make hers pink. Let's put this guy in Levi's, you know, or cords.
Or you just make the whole thing black and white.
Right. And you can always do that, too. But a lot of people are purists. They really like the color pictures. I'm not into the old black and white movies. They've made color. If they're black and white, leave them black and white.
I feel the same way, yeah. All right, great stuff, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
That wraps up our show for this week. Thanks once again to Richard Boston from the Loveland, Colorado area for sharing with us his story of his great-great-grandmother's quilt and all the names on it relating back to the Civil War and what his research is telling him. And to Hank Jones for sharing those incredible tales on the show. Take care. We'll talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.